I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour has written two very interesting pieces in separate articles in The Atlantic. The first, nobody knew governing could be so complicated. The Obama years left Republicans with excellent ratings from the Heritage Foundation and no idea how to whip a vote. He writes, the GOP's inability to maneuver a health care bill through the House after 7 years of promises to repeal and replace Obamacare is emblematic of a deeper dysfunction that grips the party. Dysfunction may not be as easy to cure as Ryan and other GOP leaders believe. Our guest has also written a piece on Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, so we'll talk about that as well. And joining us this hour is McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's author of The Wilderness, a book about the battle over the future of the Republican Party. Was previously a senior writer for BuzzFeed News Politics Team. And we will be welcoming phone calls on this issue this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Lines are open for you. Take a line whenever you would like to. McKay Coppins, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, it is pretty amazing after all these years and all these votes to repeal Obamacare that this bill went down the way that it did. Tell me about how it may signal a deeper dysfunction that is gripping the party.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Right after the House leadership decided to pull the bill and announced there wouldn't be any vote because they didn't have the votes to pass it, Paul Ryan went out and gave kind of a defeated press conference. And I think he kind of diagnosed part of the problem, which is he said, you know, for 10 years, we have been a party of opposition. We've been the party of no. And now that we're actually in position to pass legislation and govern and actually enact the ideas that we've been talking about for the past decade, we have not figured out how to shift into gear to be able to do that. And this was a pretty obvious demonstration of that. Now, I think he's right about the problem, but I think he downplays a little bit how easy it's going to be to solve it. And the point that I tried to make in that piece in The Atlantic is that the Obama years for the Republican Party really kind of cleared their bench of savvy deal makers and legislators, right? So in other words, the kind of people in Congress who actually know how to craft legislation that gets enacted into law, they have a very specific skill set. They are people who are kind of wheeler dealer types. They know how to build consensus. They know how to seek out areas where they have common interests or their interests might align. And they know how to whip votes. They know how to keep their people in line. It's kind of an old guard thing. We still see some of them in the Senate. People like Mitch McConnell is kind of this old school legislator. But you really over the past 8 years or so, you've kind of seen those people vanish. And the reason is because they've been purged from the party by the flames of ideological orthodoxy. The kind of Tea Party groups, the Heritage Action type groups, these conservative groups who demanded absolute purity, ideological purity in their representatives, ended up kind of kicking out of office all the deal makers. And they're left with people who might have very bold, you know, ideas and might even be very wonkish and be well-versed in the nuances of policy, but they don't know how to actually get legislation passed. And I think we saw that happen with the healthcare vote.
You write about Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, of course, his ascent to be House Speaker. Fans on both sides, a savvy policymaker. Ezra Klein, you say, calls him arguably the most skilled policy entrepreneur of his generation. But there's a difference between a policy entrepreneur and a legislator.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of laughed when I read that piece by Ezra Klein, who's a great writer and very smart and has spent a lot of time writing about Paul Ryan. But by calling him a policy entrepreneur, that strikes me as a bit of a euphemism, because it is true that Paul Ryan is very skilled at popularizing ideas within his own party. And we've seen that through the budgets that he's crafted over the years, the kind of his specific strain of fiscal conservatism that he's been able to promote and popularize across the American right and the Republican Party. But what you notice if you actually look at Paul Ryan's record is that he has a very modest record of actually sponsoring legislation that passes, right? He's, you know, renamed a couple post offices. He's done things like that. But what he's most skilled at doing and most experienced at doing is passing legislation or crafting legislation that is not meant to actually become law, but is meant to start conversations or make points or, you know, kind of stake out an ideological position. And I think that there's a place for people like that in both parties, in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and they play an important role. But what you haven't seen traditionally is people like that be elevated to jobs like House Speaker, because the job of a House Speaker is not to just advance an agenda or popularize ideology. It's to actually pass law. And Paul Ryan does not have a lot of experience in doing that. And I think that's one of the reasons that we saw the failure of the health care bill. And one of the reasons where now, you know, it's an open question how much legislation he's going to be able to get passed through this kind of very divided house.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the past 7 years. There were so many votes to repeal Obamacare. There was so much talk about how horrible it was among Republicans. Certainly President Trump was going to have it repealed and replaced on day one of his presidency. Wasn't anybody right. working on a really, they had 7 years to fashion something that could pass the House. They have complete control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. You would have thought it would have been under very careful consideration for the past 7 years.
You would have. And I mean, to be fair, there have been, you know, policy wonks and think tanks in Washington who have spent the past 7-8 years and actually much more time than that trying to come up with conservative solutions to health care problems. I think two things happened, though, that complicated it once Republicans actually took power. One of the things is that I'm told reliably by my sources throughout, you know, the Washington Republican establishment that really nobody expected Donald Trump to actually win in November. And that includes people in Donald Trump's own party. So there were not a lot of Republicans who were actually, you know, laying the groundwork and fashioning the policy that they needed to so that they'd be ready on day one to start getting laws passed, to start passing legislation. Most people were expecting Hillary Clinton to be president and that Republicans would have to kind of continue their obstructionist approach to governance. So that's one thing that I think happened. The other thing is that for reasons that I think are not entirely clear to anyone, they were operating on an extremely abbreviated schedule here. Right. Rather than, you know, remember that when Barack Obama passed, got Obamacare passed, it was the better part of a year of whipping votes and building consensus and making appeals to the American people. I remember President Obama giving several major televised addresses on just the subject of health care over the course of 9 months. It was a really intensive, long process. And what happened in this case was that, at least this is the reporting I've seen and what I've heard from my own sources, is that Paul Ryan basically went to President Trump during the transition and said, look, I want to do health care first. I want to take on health care as our first legislative priority. It was not an issue that Donald Trump is especially motivated by. You're right that he made it a major plank of his platform when he was running for president. The reality is this was not an issue that he knew a lot about, not an issue he cared as much about as issues like trade, for example. And so he basically said, okay, Paul Ryan, go ahead. You can pursue health care, but you're going to have to do it fast. We need a fast win. And so they tried to do this in a very short amount of time, and I think that they really kind of fumbled it because they were operating on a kind of artificially fast or short deadline.
Mm-hmm. So, McKay, who's in charge now? I was watching the news last night, and it appears that Mike Pence, the vice president, is now meeting with members of the Freedom Caucus to try and get a bill that they would be happy with. Is he now in charge, or who?
Well, so they have put Mike Pence out front. I think that what they learned from this most recent kind of healthcare debacle is that they can't just believe whatever the House leadership or congressional leadership comes and tells them, right? Paul Ryan and his kind of supporters and defenders were very confident, both in public and I'm told in private while talking to the White House, that they would be able to get this passed really quickly, that they definitely had the votes. Obviously, that didn't happen. So Mike Pence, the vice president, who obviously served in the House himself in the past, is well-respected throughout the party, has been kind of tapped to be the chief negotiator now on this. It's an open question to me whether the Trump administration is willing to invest the political capital probably necessary to get a major healthcare overhaul passed. But at least for now, they're saying that they're not dropping it entirely, and Mike Pence seems to be taking the lead.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk. A major part of your article, too, which I found very interesting, is what D.C. Republicans have been doing the last 7 or 8 years. You write they're just as likely to pander to Sean Hannity as they are to their local newspaper editorial boards. And then this whole deregulation of political money, of all this money coming into from outside groups who have agendas, which may make the party committees and other, old guard gatekeepers strip them some of their power and relevance. So it's a whole different game. It's a game,
yeah,
really.
It really is. I mean, look, I was talking to a source here in D.C. who said that, you know, the last time Republicans in Congress had a really heavy lift, had a major legislative initiative succeed was way back in the Bush years with Medicare Part D. And since then, a lot of members of Congress have been voted out of their seats or retired. The Congress has been repopulated with a whole new generation of Republicans and conservatives. And the incentive structure that they now adhere to is vastly different than it was even just 10 years ago. You mentioned two forces that I think are making that happen. One is the democratization of media, or you could say the segmentation of media. No longer are Republican members of Congress simply subjected to accountability journalism from their local newspapers, local news outlets, the kind of reporters in their home district. These days, they also are spending a lot of their time pandering to Breitbart and the Daily Caller and Sean Hannity and Fox News and conservative talk radio. Those kind of national, ideological, or partisan media outlets are just as powerful, if not more so, in their districts and among their bases than the kind of local mainstream press.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big thing that's happened. The other is the deregulation of political money. You cannot overstate how much that has changed the game for a lot of these members of Congress. I mean, it used to be that, for the most part, Republicans and Democrats had to toe the party line. They had to stay in line. They had to be on good terms with the gatekeepers in their party. And certainly, look, there were advantages and disadvantages. There were pros and cons to that system. But what it meant was that, for the most part, you could expect that when a party was in control of the White House and both chambers of Congress, they were able to pass legislation. It was not that difficult. But what's happened since then is that there are all kinds of outside groups or even just individual billionaires who have their own very narrow agendas and are able to donate millions of dollars to support candidates or to fight candidates during election years. And that's made it so that the traditional gatekeepers, people like the RNC chairman or other people in the party, don't have the power that they once did. And that's made it much harder for them to kind of corral their members. I have a colleague here at The Atlantic who wrote a piece last week that basically argued that the Republican majority in Congress is an illusion. Yes, there are people, the majority of members of Congress have R's next to their names, but there are so many factions now within the Republican Party that you can't count on them to toe the party line and vote together.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a president, certainly. You have to factor him into all of this, because mm-hmm. does he have a party line that he's towing, or where does he figure into all of this?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think two things happened in this most recent legislative episode that we went through with healthcare that show President Trump's struggle to pass legislation, and I think forecast some of those problems. One of them is that it became very clear very quickly that President Trump was not immersed in the details of the policy of this legislation that he was trying to get passed. He couldn't speak to it authoritatively, whether it was in public or in private. You heard from lawmakers, Republican lawmakers in Congress, who said that President Trump would come in and say, "We need you to vote for this." But once lawmakers started to voice their specific concerns with the bill, the actual policy, Trump would kind of just withdraw, or he wouldn't be able to actually address those specific concerns. And so I think that that's one issue. The other issue is that, and this is probably the bigger one, is that President Trump is not necessarily an ideological conservative, strictly speaking.
Right.
He's conservative on some issues, but he's really promoting his own kind of brand of nationalist populism, I think you can call it, that is distinct from the traditional left-right spectrum, right? And so there's this whole ideological realignment happening within the Republican Party as they're trying to pass legislation. And I think a big problem is that it's not, even the most cynical, self-interested lawmakers who just want to, vote whichever way the wind is blowing, they don't actually know which way the wind is blowing. They don't know if the future of the Republican Party is Trumpism or if it's kind of Paul Ryan-style conservatism. Mm. And that's one of the calculations that's being made right now. Mm.
So, McKay, give me an issue, be it tax reform or building a wall or whatever the current issues are, that you think the president and the conservative Republicans and the more moderate Republicans can all agree on so they could have a much needed and very welcome victory?
That's becoming increasingly difficult to answer, but it's a good question. I think so. I think that, to be simplistic here, there is broad consensus in the Republican Party around the issue of taxes, in that basically everyone wants to cut them, right? Everyone in the Republican Party wants lower taxes, both for the middle class and, frankly, for the wealthy. They believe pretty broadly that lower taxes will be better for economic growth, and that philosophically, the lower the taxes, the better, basically. Where the divisions come into play and where I think that they're going to run into problems is that there's this rule in Congress that they want to do it in a deficit neutral way, right? So they need to find a way to pay for these tax cuts, and there is no amount of consensus or no serious agreement within the Republican Party about how to pay for these taxes. The Trump White House has put out their own budget, which guts a lot of pretty popular federal programs, and I know a lot of Republicans are not happy with that, but it does not touch the major entitlement programs like Social Security. And there are people like Paul Ryan and his faction of Republicans who believe that the only way to pay for these, for tax cuts and to really achieve sound fiscal policy is to reform or overhaul programs like Medicare and Social Security. Mm-hmm. So when you get into the question of how do we pay for tax cuts, no one is really clear on that, and there's no serious consensus. I think, though, at 50,000 foot level, sure, every Republican would like to cut taxes.
McKay Coppins is our guest this hour. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he is author of The Wilderness, a book about the battle over the future of the Republican Party. And he's written two pieces for The Atlantic that we thought were worth talking about. We've talked quite a bit about nobody knew governing could be so complicated. The Obama years left Republicans with excellent ratings from the Heritage Foundation and no idea how to whip a vote. The other thing that we have yet to talk much about is Representative Jason Chaffetz, when we were talking about how many people are rushing to get on Sean Hannity's show, and rather than go to the editorial board of the local newspaper, Chaffetz is probably a case in point because he really made a name for himself by always being available, particularly on weekends, for television cable news programs. And before you knew it, everybody knew who he was. Utah Republican Jason Chaffetz, who chairs the House's Watchdog Committee. What do they do? We'll talk about that, and we'll do that as we continue. Well, welcome your phone calls. As always, here's how you reach the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Particularly interested in hearing from you, what would you like the Republicans to concentrate on right now? Were you devastated if you voted Republican in the last election? Are you devastated that health care reform didn't take place? Do you want them to fashion a bill? And if so, what kind of bill that would be to your liking? Is tax reform something that would be good for the Republicans to work on? What about building the wall? We certainly welcome your phone calls. And why do you think it is that there aren't these, you know, well-groomed sort of politicians among Republican ranks, and maybe among Democrats, too? We'll ask McKay if he thinks the Democrats suffer from the same problem here, that money in politics has changed everything, and the wheeler dealers, the people who used to be able to, you know, trade deals and make deals, that those days are over because of the world in which we live. Well, we welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Hour two of our program today, the Great Lakes region of the U.S., which of course includes Wisconsin, is home to over 50 million people, many of whom have been through a rough time with the loss of good-paying manufacturing jobs. It has been perceived, our part of the country, as flyover country. How dare they, by outsiders. But according to our guest from the Urban Institute, many of the country's social, economic, and political challenges are happening right here. And we will talk about how to make this region thriving again. You'll be surprised and interested in some of the recommendations from the Urban Institute. That's coming up hour two of our program. This hour, McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic. And we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Matthew in Cross Plains is our first caller. Hello, Matthew.
Yeah, hello. Very interesting conversation today. I guess I would differ a little bit with your guest in suggesting that the problem with the Republican health care initiative and its failure was really not at all related to strategy in my mind, but really one of substance. I think a lot of people in healthcare, and I'm in healthcare, would suggest that the Affordable Care Act was literally the most conservative form of healthcare reform that stands on its own. And the alternatives would really be something along the lines of a single payer plan or no healthcare at all in terms of a national system. And it was that conflict. That trying to create something more conservative than the Affordable Care Act that actually would stand on its own, would make logical sense and be financially sustainable, that led to its failure. No amount of strategy would fix that. And so that's sort of my thought. A lot of analysis is focused on strategy, but I think the fundamental problem is substance.
Thank you so much for your call, Matthew McKay.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that substance is a major part of it. And I think that one thing he got at is right, which is that the ideological factions in Congress, and that's both on right and left, had real, genuine grievances with this bill, with the substance of this bill. So the Freedom Caucus, which ultimately I think you could argue was the biggest force in kind of tanking this bill, they believe that healthcare should have as little, or the federal government should have as little to do as possible with healthcare. And what they basically argued, and what you hear them say, is that this Republican healthcare bill is Obamacare light. It still did way too much to kind of entangle the government with the healthcare system and with, which is 1/5 of the American economy, that basically the repeal of Obamacare should be replaced with as little government meddling as possible. Now, look, you can argue whether that's right or wrong, whether it's good or bad, but it was a genuine ideological belief, and it was a consistent ideological belief. And the Republicans that held out had real issues with the substance of it. Then there were Republicans on the other side, the more moderate Republicans, who felt like the healthcare bill, particularly as they were making changes kind of in the final days to try to rustle up enough votes to pass it, was becoming far too austere. They were stripping coverage of essential services. They were tinkering with the laws that had to do with pre-existing conditions. They were making the law even more unpalatable and more unpopular to the broader American public. And I think that the caller is right, that ultimately it was the substance that tanked the bill. I would dispute, though, that there was no way to pass a bill like this through Congress. I think the reality is, if they had taken more time to craft the legislation more carefully, and then to really put in the time to build consensus within their caucus, I think they could have done it. But that's not the path they took.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend just a moment. Many of our calls will be applicable to healthcare and to your first article, but I want to spend just a little while, because he's an indication of some of the people you were talking about who are able to get, who know how to maneuver the press and when to be available and can become rising stars as a result of this. You have a very interesting article about Jason Chaffetz, Utah Republican who chairs the House's watchdog committee. I'm not sure what his job is these days, but his story is interesting, and also his this whole idea of a lot of Republicans who are very concerned, particularly after the Access Hollywood tape about Donald Trump, Chaffetz being one of them, who have embraced Donald Trump. And I'm wondering I want you to talk about Chaffetz for a little while, and yeah, what in the world his job is.
Well, so yeah, he's a Utah congressman, comes from an extremely conservative district, probably one of the most conservative districts in the country, but not necessarily a district where Donald Trump is very popular. The Utah 3rd Congressional District is heavily Mormon, heavily socially conservative, and Donald Trump, while he did carry the state of Utah, he did so with only a modest plurality. Jason Chaffetz is currently chairman of the House Oversight and Government Accountability Committee, I believe is the kind of mouthful of a name for the committee. But basically what he's supposed to do is he's supposed to be the chamber's chief watchdog when it comes to the executive branch of the federal government. He is supposed to be ferreting out waste, fraud, and abuse of power in the executive branch or in the White House. He's supposed to be holding President Trump accountable. He can lead investigations. He has subpoena power. His job is basically to hold the president accountable. He, as chairman of that committee, he could have been setting himself up for a pretty good partisan gig for the next 4 years if Hillary Clinton
yes.
had won, because
right.
no question he would have been launching, a series of high-profile investigations into the Clinton administration, and he would have been getting a whole lot of, positive coverage from the conservative media that we've been talking about. But instead, Donald Trump is president, and he's been catching a lot of flack in the early days of the Trump presidency here because he seems entirely uninterested in actually investigating the Trump administration. And I will say in the piece, to his credit, he spent a good amount of time with me and answering my questions for this piece. But I walked through all the potential scandals that a lot of people are calling on Congress to investigate. They include Donald Trump's business entanglements, his potential conflicts of interest, his potential collusion with the Russian government. These are all issues that are, you know, certainly you could argue are ripe for investigation. And a lot of his constituents, both on the right and the left, have called on him to investigate. And, you know, point by point, with each one I mentioned, he kind of just shrugged them off. You know, with what, one of the specific things I brought up was a New York Times investigation that found that Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump's husband, his family is exploring a $400 million business deal with the Chinese government or with a Chinese company at the same time that Jared Kushner is serving as a foreign policy advisor to the president. Certainly, you can make a case that this is a conflict of interest, or at least creates the possibility for conflicts of interest. But Jason Chaffetz's answer was it's not a big deal. That doesn't warrant an investigation. He doesn't want to go on a fishing expedition. And his kind of umbrella comment that he made to me on all these things was, look, Donald Trump is already rich. He didn't run for president to get richer. And so I don't see any point in kind of obsessing over all these conflict of interest issues.
Yeah.
Which I, you know, it's fair to say it was a pretty controversial comment.
Right.
I think that. Go ahead.
You also write, McKay, see, I don't know how you reconcile his behavior now with what he said. Chaffetz, you write, the first Republican in Congress to officially withdraw his endorsement from Trump, and he milked the moment for all it was worth, you write, going on for several minutes in an interview about, after the Access Hollywood, Trump's abhorrent and offensive language, the awful place the nominee had put the country in, how he could no longer look his teenage daughter in the eyes while supporting this candidacy. And 2.5 weeks later, he announced he would vote for Trump after all, and now he doesn't see any conflicts of interest. I mean, what gives here?
Well, to Chaffetz's longtime critics, that whole episode around the Access Hollywood tape toward the end of the presidential campaign was really representative of all of Chaffetz's worst qualities. That he's accused of being kind of a shameless opportunist, a brazen partisan, and somebody who never met a camera that he didn't like. You alluded to this when you were talking about the story earlier, but one of the ways that he's risen so quickly through the ranks because in Republican Congress, because he only was elected in 2008, I believe. One of the ways that he did this was by just never saying no to a press interview early on. He actually told me that when he was first elected to Congress, he wanted to maximize his voice and his influence. And one of the ways to do that was to invest in his relationships with the media. And so he told me he would take regular trips from D.C. up to Manhattan so he could meet with cable news producers and bookers and make sure that they remembered who he was so that they could book him. And then he said that, you know, when it came time that they needed a Republican congressman to come on TV, and it was a beautiful sunny Saturday afternoon, and right. No one wanted to spend time doing it, he would jump at the chance. So he is kind of the model, like you said, of a certain breed of camera mugging conservative congressman that we've seen kind of rise in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Brian in Madison is next. Hello, Brian.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Brian.
I've just got a real quick note for you. I have a friend who went to high school with Paul Ryan, and his nickname was Eddie Haskell. Does that ring a bell? I mean, I was born in 51. I'm older than a lot of you guys, but to me, it just fits completely. So that's all I've got.
That's it, huh, Brian?
I will say I've heard that. He was actually, I think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think he was voted biggest brown noser in high school. So he did have that streak, that kind of kiss-up streak. From very early on in his life.
So where is he going from here? Is he going to be heavily involved in tax reform legislation? Will he try to refashion a health care bill? What's his relationship with the president? He wasn't very happy about Donald Trump either. And are they on the mends? What's going on there?
Well, I think he's trying to work with President Trump. I mean, I think the reality is that Paul Ryan, you know, was repelled by Donald Trump personally. I think he was repelled by a lot of the things Trump ran on. But once Trump won, Paul Ryan saw this as a once-in-a-generation, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Republicans to pass all this legislation that he's been talking about for so long,
exactly.
Right? I mean, and I think that, you know, the people close to him who I've talked to say that was the reason that he was willing to give Trump a pass on so much of this other stuff, because he felt like Republicans, it's so rare that Republicans hold or control the White House and both chambers of Congress. I think that in a way it's kind of a, you know, depending on what your partisan feelings are, maybe you won't feel this way, but I think that you could make a case that it's kind of a tragic story for Paul Ryan, because he compromised so much and sacrificed so much to get to this moment, and now it looks like he might not even be able to pass any of these big legislative initiatives that he's been dreaming of for so long.
Mm. Let's go to a couple Facebook comments, and you can respond to what you'd like to. Tim on Facebook writes, I guess if you spend 8 years doing everything you can to keep things from happening, you kind of forget how hard it is to make things happen. Thomas on Facebook writes, the GOP is not a pro-community, pro-society party. They are blinded by their hatred of government until they can bend it to their favor and their selfish economic interests. The rest of us were not important. What do you say, McKay?
Yeah, I mean, I think to the first post that you read, I think there is certainly something to that. I mean, look, the reality is it is incredibly difficult, even under normal circumstances and even before all the changes to the political landscape that have happened. It was always hard to pass big legislative bills. It was always hard to overhaul major segments of the economy or the government. And it required a certain kind of expertise. It required people who had patience and experience. It also required, by the way, bipartisan relationships, of which there are very few in Congress these days. And I think that it's certainly true that when, after spending so long making the strategic decision to try to just block everything that Barack Obama tried to do, and that was their kind of stated goal, that was their stated objective. After trying to do that for so long, makes it hard to remember that, you know, passing actual legislation is difficult, and you need goodwill, you need relationships, you need to be able to come to the bargaining table with Democrats and have them trust you. And right now, trust and goodwill are in such short supply here in Washington that it is very hard for me to envision Democrats and Republicans coming together for any kind of grand bargains or compromises.
Do the Democrats suffer from some of the same problems with finding people who are willing to make deals with people who really can help fashion legislation?
Yes. I think that what they're suffering through is a little bit different. I think that when a member of your party controls the White House for 8 years, that person traditionally in the White House, the president, is the one who leads out on legislation, right? They're the one. So President Obama and his White House have been the driving force behind the legislative agenda for Democrats for the past 8 years. And I think that probably has left a lot of legislators on the left a little bit rusty, right? But I don't think that I think that the ideological war that has kind of ravaged the Republican Party for the past decade is kind of just starting now in the Democratic Party. You saw in this most recent primary, the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton really did represent wings of the party, and there's this divide between so-called liberals and so-called leftists. And I think that that war is just now beginning. The Democratic Party is just sort of now wandering into the wilderness. And time will tell who emerges, what that party emerges looking like. But I think that they could be undergoing some of the same things that the Republican Party did during the Trump era.
So when you look at leaders, earlier you mentioned Mitch McConnell as being an old school kind of wheeler and dealer, could get things done. In the House, well, in the Senate, is there a Democrat of comparable stature? And when you look at those who are able to get things done in the House, Democratic or Republican, what names do you come up with?
Sure. Well, in the Senate, Chuck Schumer is actually kind of a legendary wheeler-dealer type. Some liberals would say to his own fault, that he's more interested in getting legislation done than holding firm to the kind of liberal principles that a lot of leftists would like him to. That said, sure. There, I think you hear a lot of Democrats these days say that the party is going to miss Harry Reid, and the reason for that is that Harry Reid was known widely throughout Washington as being kind of a bare knuckled negotiator. He was willing to do things that maybe were right on the line of ethical, or maybe past that line, but it was all in pursuit of the Democrats' agenda. He was really a fighter. And what I think a lot of Democrats today say that they're lacking in Washington is somebody who's willing to do the things that Harry Reid did. Harry Reid, of course, just retired as the Democratic leader in the Senate. Chuck Schumer has taken his place. He's much more of a deal maker. He is somebody who likes to pursue bipartisan consensus. There is not a lot of appetite, though, on the left or in the Democratic Party to come to the table and try to work with Donald Trump. So I'm not sure, even if there were more kind of wheeler-dealer types, I'm not sure that there would be a lot of appetite from the voters or from the base for them to, try to get big things done with President Trump.
More phone calls in just one moment. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. McKay Coppins is our guest, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking about a couple pieces that he's written recently for The Atlantic. Nobody knew governing could be so complicated. And the second is The Prince of Oversight, which profiles Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who chairs the House Oversight Committee. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. Because they've been in power, out of power for such a long period of time and now dominate the House, the Senate, and the White House, the Republicans, some are saying, are having a difficult time figuring out how to be more than the party of no, but how to get through legislation that will be agreeable to everybody, to all factions in the Republican Party. And if the health care situation is any indication, this is not going to be an easy thing to do because of the factions and a lack of people who are able to make deals. What do you think? Do you think that the Republicans will work this out? Are there pieces of legislation that you, if you support that agenda, really believe need to happen? And who can guide that legislation? What do you think about Paul Ryan's leadership here? Is he too much a policy wonk and not a legislator? We would love to hear from you. And we'll start taking more phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next hour, we'll take a look at the economic and social trends that are shaping the Great Lakes region. Back to phone calls. Dennis is next in Nisida. Hi, Dennis. Hello, Dennis. I don't know where you went, but if you'd like to talk, call us back. Ron in Portage. Hello, Ron.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Like I said earlier, I said Obamacare, as we call it, is the law of the land. Let's accept that. If your car breaks, you fix it. We got all these legislators, all them people up there. Fix it. Why can't they do that? Okay. That's all I got to say.
All right. Thank you. Fix it, McKay. Easy to do that?
Well, not easy, though. I think that he's onto something, which is that there are clearly identifiable problems with Obamacare that Democrats and Republicans generally agree on. Premiums are too high. In some places, there are very few options, only one option for health insurance providers. There are clear problems with the way that Obamacare is currently functioning. And there are ways to fix it. I don't know that they're simple, and I don't know that there's broad consensus, but if you started from the point of saying, this is how our healthcare system is right now, let's figure out how we can fix the problems right now, I think that you would probably get a lot further than saying we need to repeal this entire law that has spent the past, however many years kind of interweaving itself into the social safety net of America and replace it with something else wholesale. I think that that's a much dimmer prospect. It's very unlikely that that's going to succeed in this current climate. Because, by the way, the thing that we haven't talked about is this thing, the Republican health care plan, has so far struggled to pass the House. It is much less likely that it's going to be able to pass the Senate if it's passed in any form that resembles the one that it took when they were trying to jam it through the House. So there is a very steep uphill climb to get a repeal bill passed. But if Republicans and Democrats came together and said, look, the healthcare system the Obamacare is struggling. There are clear and identifiable problems with the healthcare system. Let's figure out how we can fix those. I think that it's much more, that seems much more plausible and much more doable. But to get back to the original problem, there is an ideological issue, which is that some of the conservatives, some of the Tea Party holdovers in Congress simply do not believe that government should have anywhere near as much influence over the healthcare system as Obamacare allows it to be. So that's kind of the issue that seems insurmountable right now.
Spencer is next in Eau Claire. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, Joy.
It's Kathleen.
Wanda, go ahead. Or Kathleen, sorry.
That's all right.
No, I was just going ahead and saying that conservatism and liberalism don't really mean what they used to back in the day. I always thought that conservatism was about trying to come up with fiscally responsible policy, and liberalism was about trying to see what the needs of society were. And that just what your guest was saying there about how essentially healthcare, the costs in that need to be curtailed. And realistically, if you look at healthcare and right the way it is now, catastrophic healthcare, which many insurers are providing for people, really doesn't give a good fiscally responsible policy versus trying to provide preventative maintenance or healthcare for people. So, yeah, that was my comment. I just wish that the Congress would actually realize that what they need to do is come up with policies that work well for the people of the country and do so in a fiscally responsible fashion, too, as well.
Oh, I think a lot of people would agree with you. That's what they're there to do. This whole issue about, you would think that this could be a bipartisan study of this issue because the cost is a huge issue in this country, more so than any other country that I'm aware of on Earth. Why can't people get together and figure out what can we do to bring the cost of health care in this country down so much? It's a major issue, McKay.
It is a major issue, and anybody who's spent time in a hospital can attest to that. I think the problem is, like with so many issues, that even when there is consensus around how to solve one problem, or even the potential for consensus, both parties and ideological factions want to tie it to something broader so that they can advance other elements of their agenda, right? And so, while Republicans and Democrats might be able to come together around how to lower the cost of health care. Certainly President Trump has expressed an interest in that. They can't get together on some of the just most fundamental philosophical questions about our health care system. And because of that, it's very difficult for them to tackle these problems in kind of a technocratic, pragmatic way.
Thank you, Spencer, very much for your comments. Alex in Madison, hi.
Hi. So I've got a question. I've been hearing this, and you have mentioned this before, that both sides don't like to get along. Now, what my question is that do they realize that just stubbornly deciding I'm not going to get along with you, do they realize that hampers progress versus furthers it, or is this a political ploy, or, like, what's their motive?
McKay, what's their motive?
Yeah. Well, I think this goes back to some of the other issues we were talking about. The incentive structure does not right now promote any kind of compromise or getting along with the other side. One of the things that we haven't mentioned, by the way, is the gerrymandering of congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over the last several years, Republicans have been able to redraw districts in states throughout the country in ways that make it so that they are incredibly safe in their districts. There are a lot of districts in this country now that have been drawn in such a way that it's, you know, 60, 70, 75% Republican. And if you're a congressional representative from a district that is 70% Republican, you are not worried about a general election challenge from a Democrat, which means that you don't really have very much incentive to work with Democrats. What you're worried about is a primary challenge from somebody who's more conservative than you. And so the redrawing of these districts, the gerrymandering of these districts, has profound consequences in the way that Republican congressmen approach their jobs and the kind of incentives that they're operating under. And
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there just isn't a lot of appetite from the base in either party to spend a lot of time making compromises and deals with the other side.
Yeah. Reminds me, we need to revisit that because Wisconsin has a case that's going to the Supreme Court on gerrymandering. McKay, thanks. We're out of time. Had a good time with you. Thank you. Join us again.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, our pleasure. McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of The Future of the Republican Party, The Battle Over the Future. We thank Chris Molina for producing this hour and Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your interesting phone calls. News is coming up, and we'll return to talk about the future of the Great Lakes.